Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is mastering engineer Mayor Applebaum. First of all, a study published by Scientific Reports that looked at the top five positions of the Billboard singles chart since 1950 has found the complexity of song rhythms and pitch arrangements has decreased, but the average number of notes played per second has increased. They also identified two significant decreases in melodic complexity that occurred in 1975 and again in 2000, along with a much smaller decrease in 1996. The authors speculate that the melodic changes that occurred in 1975 may be the result of the rise of genres like new wave and disco and stadium rock. Those occurring in 1996 and the year 2000 could represent the rise of hip-hop or the adoption of the digital audio workstation, which meant that a lot more loops and samples are being used. They also found that complexity of musical elements has increased during that time period, which basically means that the emphasis has been on sound quality and production rather than melody. Another study also published by Scientific Reports found that the lyrics of English language songs have become much simpler and more repetitive over the past 40 years. The bottom line is that songwriting and music production have been affected by technology for better or for worse. That said, things always seem to cycle back around. It's just a matter of time when that will happen. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all of my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. The background noise of a typical city can be pretty intense, as we all know, but there are still places in the United States that are as quiet as in ancient times. Scientists have looked at 1.5 million hours of acoustic monitoring in both cities and national parks to find that most cities have an average noise level of between 50 and 60 dB. On the other hand, Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming and the Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado have background noise levels lower than 20 dB. Other super quiet spaces include the Hoh Rainforest in Washington State, Glacier National Park in Montana, Big Bend National Park in Texas, Boundary Waters Canoe Wilderness in Minnesota, and the Bold Coast of Maine. 83% of Americans live in cities where the noise pollution from modern-day city life is a fact of life. There are a number of quiet places to go to, however, if you want to get away from it all and rest your ears. My guest this week is mastering engineer Mayor Applebaum, who's worked with the likes of Faith No More, Yes, Meat Loaf, Eric Gales, Walter Trout, Dream Theater, Sepultura, Halford, and many more. Mayor has written presets and collaborated with various plugin companies such as Waves, Brainworks Plugin Alliance, Softube, Arturia, Leapwing Audio, Pulsar Audio, and others. He's also guested and lectured at various trade shows and recording schools, and is the co-creator of the Oven line of analog hardware, which is modeled and emulated by Brainworks. During our interview, Mayor spoke about the different mastering requirements for different genres, common mixing problems that he sees, what he asks clients to supply for mastering, the audio gear he's developed, and so much more. I spoke with Mayor via Zoom from a studio outside of Los Angeles. You started to tell me at lunch the other day some of your background. So I want to start there about how you get into mastering.
Well, I think I started like a lot of people. They had bands of their own or, you know, either played music or liked working with music. So I studied sound engineering and I worked in rehearsal rooms. That way I was exposed to a lot of types of music and I did some times live sound a bit, and you know, you kind of do the jack of all trade things, whatever audio you can get in your hands into, you do. But then I found that it wasn't that lucrative money wise, and I still wanted to do it, So I took a job as a broadcasting engineer. And I've done that for about 8 years. And that paid my bills while I could do the other stuff, which was either working in rehearsal rooms or recording my own bands and even doing some mastering back then. So it was basically, I had a technical job, which included audio and video, and that paid me, the bills, and then I could focus on the art of doing the recordings with my bands and projects that I've done. And so I was just doing a lot of that because it wasn't a money factor. I could just keep doing that as long as I had my day job, which was still related to it. I was also a DJ at clubs and a music journalist. So I was always involved in the last part of it, not like the last part in terms of like playing it to the people in the club. I had radio shows that I was guesting on, or I had my own radio show, like internet radio. This goes back like 2004. So I was DJing in the radio shows at the clubs, and being a music journalist helped me kind of understand it as the person who's presenting it kind of to the people. And having some experience in sound engineering, you also connect the dots more. And doing some live sound and working in the studios, that helped me, gain more knowledge and experience. And I really felt that mastering was the place where I should go to because it was fitting what I was already doing in terms of the presentation. It's exactly the last step before it goes out to the radio, to the DJs, to the music journalists. You know what I mean? It's the last creative and technical part of the production. And I really felt close to that. So it was just a natural progression. And I started as dabbling with it, doing it for me, for my friends, slowly doing it more for like small bands that some of them just didn't even sound close to good. And I was just making them less bad or almost listenable. But you learn how to do something with, if life gives you lemon, you make lemonades, right? If you, sorry, I reversed. I said, if life gives you lemon, you make lemonades. Maybe that's true. That's what I probably did. I reversed the process, but yeah, that's what basically I did most of the time, and I got better at that. And then later on, after I finished working, and doing all that stuff, I wanted to progress, but we were limited in what we could. There were not many mastering studios in Israel, and most of them were dealing with specific genres that are there. So there was not much experience in the genres that are like different types of rock and different types of alternative music, and it was mostly Israeli music. So I wanted to branch out to the music that is not as common there, but they were emerging artists there. So I figured, well, the best thing I can do is probably go out, see the world, and learn and experience. Back then, social media was not like today. There were no forums like this now, like where there were no podcasts, or getting the knowledge was really like you got to dig in the ground, you got to be there, you got to, work hard. So I had an opportunity to go to work for Sylvia Massey up in Weed, California, because I worked with a band from Israel that she worked with, and I mastered their songs, and she and I got a connection there, and she heard it, and she offered me the option to come and work there.
As a mastering engineer for her?
So it was kind of like, come and do some mastering if you want, and do other stuff in the studio too, because There were some bands that local that were recording there, or some smaller bands, but the other bands that came there usually master outside. But I anyway needed a solution for learning and being exposed to other types of music. So the first thing I thought of is like, okay, if I go there, I'll be exposed to music regardless of mastering. You know, it's other music coming in. It's they're doing tracking and mixing there and the whole process and the production. So I'll be exposed to that. And that's something that you pick up from, and you can carry that to other things. And that's why I felt that that is an important milestone in the career, because you know, I can sit in a room, four wall room, right, and be exposed to one thing, but having the knowledge and seeing kind of the big pictures is always something that can enrich your understanding of the process. And from that, when you talk to a mixing engineer or a producer, you know where they're from, where they're coming from. You know, you can understand if they're saying there's certain struggles, there's certain things, there's certain elements in the process. You're not like, oh, I don't know what that is. You know, you've seen it. You know, you've been exposed to it. So to me, that was very important. And it proved itself, because I came there and I was basically kind of working in the studio doing different jobs. You know, if it was, you know, moving gear from different places, connecting the gear, you know, assisting on a session, tracking a session, assisting on mixing, mastering was the stuff that I did, you know, for some of the bands there. But being involved in each part of the process taught me a lot about working with the gear and working as part of the team, which is, at the end of the day, what we are. We're part of a team. You know, just because I do the mastering doesn't mean I'm on my own and there's no other people involved, right? It always has to fit with the music, with the vision, with the production. So that gave me a lot of opportunities to learn and get exposed to the different parts of the process, and also knowing what I like and what to do more and what less. And it helped me out.
Do you come to LA then after that?
So I worked for Sylvia about, you know, about 8 months, every day, most of the day. Like, you know, we lived in that studio. It was a place in Weed, which had about four studios, different consoles, different, you know, different gear and rooms. And after that, which was, like I said, it was every day, all day, including the weekend. After that, I moved to LA and I started my own thing. And I took a job at Samesh during the day. And that way I could pay the bills, you know, starting out, you know, the rent and the car and all that. And in the night, I was doing some mastering work with people I already knew from Israel or other people who I got connected with during the process of moving to the US. And while I was working for Sylvia, and when I came to LA, I met more people and got some more opportunities. So I did that for a few months. And then after that, I couldn't combine the two, because the full day shift plus mastering, and in the night I was mostly mastering. So I had to leave the job at Samesh, and which I learned a lot as well from that, because you communicate with clients, you find solutions for them, you know, that helps you understand the client's needs. And of course I learned about gear and stuff like that, because I was selling that. And then I just focused on the mastering. That's what I've been doing here in America.
When you first started to master, How long did it take you before you felt, okay, I'm good at this. I know how to do it.
It's a great question, because I think there was a point where I really felt confident and comfortable with it, and then came in projects that were challenging. And then you reevaluate yourself and you're like, you know what? Maybe I'm not there yet. You know, there's like, it's like you're climbing a mountain and you're like, okay, I'm there. And then you think you can make it. And then there's a big bump. And after that, you're like, okay, I got to retrain myself. I think it's like levels where you think there's like 10 levels in the game. When you get to 9, at that end of, you're like, okay, I'm going to go to 10. The moment you switch to 10, you're like, you thought you're there. And now, like, oh, there's 20 more levels that I didn't know about before. And then when you finish those 12, you get to almost to that finish and you're like, oh my God, there's another 100, which I wasn't even aware. So it's really dependent on the type of projects that came in. And sometimes there's a lot of projects where you need to be very intrusive and very, you know, a lot of changes needed. And then there's projects that need barely. And you might not know that because you're so used to making so big changes, and now you got to be minimal. And you're like, oh, I don't know how to do that because I know how to do that only. And then you got to restart your thinking. It's like, oh, maybe I need to work on that way. So I think it depends what you do in the beginning of your career, and then that affects how you're confident with your work, especially if you're changing your monitoring situation and gear. And I went through that for a long time. Like, I changed a lot of gear. I changed rooms. There's rooms I've been there for a long time too. I improved my monitoring. So to say that, yeah, I know where I'm at, and I feel confident with it today, yes. But it doesn't mean that before I couldn't do it. It just means that before I was doing it to a degree that I felt that I was confident enough, but there were challenges that came in that were changing the perspective. And then I learned from that just because you got 100 records sounding amazing, it doesn't mean 101 and 102 would work exactly. So you always need to bring your experience, but understand that every record is a new learning experience and it has new challenges. And it doesn't always have to do with how you hear it. A lot of times it's how the client hears it. And you might do the thing that you think is best for it, but the client steers you to a different direction, and you got to understand their vision too, whether you're liking it or not, or it might be good, but you just need to be open to it.
Is there a type of music that you find more challenging to work on than others?
You know, it's a very good question, because I think every music has its own book of ideas that you can, you know what I mean? Like, for example, when you work on fast music, like metal, for example, the low end can easily muddy the sound because the BPM is fast and the kick drum is running fast. So that's where you need to, like, a lot of times be very tight in the sound. Where in other genres, sometimes the low end can bloom and be very round and, you know, smooth. Like, it's like they're so different. And I think that having experience in different types of music is very important, but it's a longer way of learning. Like, if you focus on one genre for a long time, you can get really good at it, and it could be your calling card. Once you start spreading yourself to a lot of other genres, every genre that comes in is a new learning curve, because each genre has not only its own genre, but it's inside it has subgenres and different aesthetics. And now each one is like, oh, but these ones are more soft and these ones are more bright and these ones, you know, it's like each one can have different aesthetics. And I think every genre can be hard depending on what you get. And just because a project is almost perfect doesn't mean it's easy. sometimes those projects are the hardest because it's easy to ruin them. If they're all placed really well, every little thing you do is not magic.
Yeah.
Every little thing you do can cause harm. So you really got to be conscious about what you're doing because it could change the inner balance between the instruments just because you change a few frequencies. And at the same time, genres or mixes that are very dense and maybe not as perfect sitting, those can also kind of be a challenge because you want to improve it, but there's limitations to how much you can improve it without ruining it. Because again, when you improve it, sometimes the power and the energy that was the problem, like for example, too much muddiness, too much low end, or even too much high end, when you try to fix that, now it doesn't sound energetic. Now it loses the power. And basically, you fix the problem and you created a new one.
Yeah.
So the challenge is that you're dealing with stereo track, and whatever you're doing to it is improving it by degrading it because you're changing what it was. But that, and by changing what it was, you're losing the fidelity in a way. So you're degrading it, but it could be in a positive way because now you're fixing a problem and you're making it sound better because you altered it. But sometimes it's the opposite, you know?
Yeah. When you get mixes in that you think there's a problem, is it the same one that keeps popping up all the time? Or is there a common problem that you hear in mixes that come into you?
I think nowadays the gamut is bigger than before. Years ago, certain problems were similar, and that was mostly low end, where there was like too much low end because either the rooms or the speakers that people had at home, if it was home studios, not all of them had enough low end extension. And they would just push the low end, and you would get mixes with a lot of low end that you had to clean up. Later on, the problem was low end and high end because what happened is they added a lot of low end, but they added a lot of high end because the low end was masking the high end. Once you take some of the low end out, the high end was just popping out. So those things are basically monitoring situations, and they usually would happen due to small rooms or untreated rooms, untuned rooms. The other problems that I found sometimes were the artist would work on a project for a long time, they get tired, and they would overprocess certain things to the point where you would get like too much saturation, not in an artistic way, just that they didn't even hear, you know, that things were either too harsh, abrasive, bright, or sometimes levels of certain instruments and like cymbals would pop out, or they would have sibilants and vocals, but the cymbals were dark. And then when you wanted to clean the vocals more, you would actually dull more the cymbals, or the opposite, cymbals were bright, vocals were dull. You know, the imbalances. I think most of that is a part of monitoring, but also today you have so many options in terms of processing, and it's easy to, without noticing it, just applying, processing, and then there's less separation between the instruments. Even if there is a need for a glue, sometimes the glue is too much and it's hard to undo it because now if they take something off, then things will jump too much. So I think a lot of that has to do with when you have a long time to work on a project, you know, because it's ongoing, then sometimes you don't listen to the other songs or reference or have an ear break. And sometimes when you rush to a project too much too, you have the same effect that you're just not noticing that you print something with a problem, like offline bouncing, for example. There are a lot of times where I get a track and I hear a problem there, and it's not an artistic problem. Automation stopped or something jumped, and it's because they didn't listen to it in real time because it was a bounce to disc. And then I get the track, and like, for example, you see a verse like really small, and then a chorus jump like really, really loud, or the opposite, or some kind of line that was working somewhere and then it stopped. And then the first thing I ask is if it was an offline bounce. And if the answer is yes, I'll say, I'm hearing this and this. Did you notice it? Or can you listen to the offline bounce and check? And that's something that can happen a lot. I think nowadays, especially when you have like 200 tracks and automations running, those things. But I think overall, the issues today with the low end and are less because there's more people that have treated rooms that are much better, and they have better speakers to work with. And a lot of the producers now basically have a better starting point in terms of, the DAW, all the plugins they need. If they have hardware too, they have better conversion too. So you get less of those problems that you would get back then. The other set of problems you get is sometimes things are just overprocessed or not noticed that something happened during the bounce.
I get it. Okay, so if someone calls you and say, "I want you to master my project," what would you like me to send you? What do you tell them? Is there a certain level, or take the limiter off, or anything like that?
So the first thing I asked them is, for example, if it's a producer that did it for a band, a client of them, I asked them, did you make a loud version and a non-loud version? Or did you mix into a limiter? And if they say, yes, we mixed into a limiter or a mastering chain, then I say, can you send me two files, one with it on and one without? Same case if, let's say, they made a version for the client with a limiter, or a multiband, or whatever it is. I asked them to send me the same, both files with and without, at the same sample rate and bit depth. So to me, when I listen to them, they're equal in terms of quality of the specs of the file. So it's a WAV file, same sample rate, same bit depth. If they have certain fade outs or fade ins, include that in too, so I know how it's supposed to be. Years ago, back then, I would ask for a certain level because I noticed that sometimes people were hitting it hard and it just didn't sound good. And back then, I think the DAWs were not handling hot mixes as well, and some of the plugins couldn't handle it as well as good. But nowadays, the DAWs have, I think they have a better headroom. They can handle it. Plugins are much better. They can work with hotter signals. So just give me one with and one without. I also ask for screenshots sometimes because certain projects have certain processing. And if there's a problem, like I hear something weird, if I look at the screenshots of the master bus, sometimes I can figure out if there's a plugin that does that. Like some plugins add, for example, a certain type of hiss or crackles And if it's on the master bus, then of course you can hear, but it could be also on a delay or somewhere else in the mix, and you might not know that. So I won't know. But having some information on the screenshots of the master bus does give me clues if there's any issues that I can maybe tell them to check that plugin and see if it does something.
You're not totally in the box, right? You like
Oh, I'm
analog gear.
hardware. 99% of my work is external.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, let's talk about your gear. You have your own gear that you've designed. How did that come about?
Well, throughout the years, I had a lot of gear from different manufacturers, and they all had something to do with the projects that I like. They all were part of what I've done, and I love that because to me, that's part of the experiment. Later on, I found that there were certain pieces that I liked more than others, and of course, you gravitate to them. And then there were things that I liked, but I wish they were a bit different. So I started modifying them. And when I started that modification process and improved some of them, then I had ideas of other things that I wanted. but I had to figure out how to do them. So I did a few simple things that I could do, but then I got in touch with some builders and had them build stuff for me of ideas that I had. So I collaborated with different people to make me custom units. Then later on, I figured why not do like stuff that is my own and not a modification or not like alteration of a build. And I've worked with Roger Foote from Foote Control Systems, and we did three units of that, the workshop, the bench, and the torch. And those are units that I only have. We thought of building them back then for more people, but parts were hard to get, and so we stayed with me having them. And then later on, I collaborated with Handy Amps, and Chris and I kept in touch for a lot of years. And then we started building this idea called the oven, which was originally for me, but in time, you make prototypes, they work, they don't work, you change them, you make new ones. But in time, we got something that sounded so good. We thought, okay, why not have this as a product, a custom product? So we did the oven. And then later on, we figured, okay, the oven sounds really good, but I want another type of tone. So we made the stove. And then we made the cooker and the grill. So they're all different units with different sounds. And they fit different things, and you can combine them too.
What do they
So
do?
they're basically stereo line processors. They're tone shapers. Some of them include EQ, some of them have less of an EQ, but certain tones like high end or low end, but they also saturate to a certain degree, not like super aggressive. They have a huge range where you can really find the sweet spot to where it sounds good, and it's not like under that is not doing anything, above that is already too much. So you can really play with it. They enhance the depth and the size and the punch and impact. And I'm using them so much. And like I said, there are different sounds and options, and sometimes you cascade them. You run one into another, or two or three, or and most of my rig today is custom gear. There are a few other pieces of gear which are either modified, or what they are, and I combine them with the custom gear. These pieces of gear, the oven line products, the oven, the stove, the grill, the cooker, they found themselves now in live rigs of big tours like the Killers and Chili Peppers and Beck and Meg Thee Stallion and Vi Satriani and Sammy Hagar and Bruno Mars. And I mean, it's really nice to see huge shows, big rigs running the mixes through that. So for me, a lot of the work is with this custom gear, and some, like I said, is other modified gear, and some is just great top tier gear that I like, and I combine. And I find that as much as plugins are amazing, and I really plugins are amazing today, the oven actually has a plugin with BrainWorks and Plugin Alliance. So that's a very successful plugin nowadays, and it's a modeled emulation of the oven. It has some of the features, and it's adapted to the plugin world. People like it. There's a lot of users all over the world, and big names too, and they love this on movies, on TV shows, on songs. But I still prefer working with hardware because I like how the reaction between one piece of gear and the other. So for me, like I said, most of my work is external. Sometimes I'll add a plugin to what I'm doing, or when I'm doing an album, I'll do the hardware, and then I'll add certain plugins to certain parts of the record, like certain songs, if I need to add certain things. I don't mind working on the hardware and then having to write down all the recall sheets. It's part of the, no pain, no gain. But I just love it. I think the thing with hardware is if you have hardware and you have plugins and you made a decision to work with hardware, you made that decision. or if you made the decision to work with the plugin, you made that decision, but it wasn't because you don't have it. You have it, and you just felt one works better than the other for the song. So for me, having a lot of the hardware, and I have a ton of other floating hardware that I can just pull in my desk, and I have a ton of plugins, I can just make the decision which one works best for me and for the project. So it's a matter of choice, not a matter of not having. So I just using what there is. Yeah. And I still prefer 99 or 98% of the work I will do is hardware. And then, of course, I might add to it, if needed, some plugins. In the box work is very rare that I do. I've done it. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying it can be done, and it can be done greatly. But in my case, it's a very small percentage of the work.
All right. Last question then brings us to the perfect place. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
So I think you can learn from your clients a lot, and to the point where sometimes the clients will teach you better than learning from videos or educational forums, because the clients is a mixed bag of opinions, and it's a mixed bag of music that comes in. Okay, your experience is based on what you work with, and their feedback, as if they like it, don't like it, or what to do if they don't like it, that's going to teach you a lot in the long run. So the more work you do, the more you'll be learning and being experienced, I think, better than if you learn certain techniques, because the techniques can get you from A to B, but understanding what a client wants could be more A to Z than A to B. And the best tips that I've got were from my clients, because I was never mentored in mastering. So to learn about it, I actually had to do something with someone and see if he digs it. And if he doesn't, how to work it to make it work. Be attentive to understanding what the client wants. And if a client is a mixer or a producer, then they're giving you knowledge just by them exchanging with you information of what they like, what they don't like. So that's one of the things that I would take more into account than anything we can read out there, because the bits don't matter. Okay, like, it doesn't matter if it's 24-bit, 32-bit floating, or 16-bit. The best records we ever grew up on were 16-bit anyway, so it doesn't matter, okay? What really matters is if you can figure out how to take that information and quantify it in those bits and not the bits themselves. And if someone sends you something of 16-bit and it sounds good, then it sounds good. You want to work with that. Okay, if he has a 24-bit, great, but don't deal with that information. Deal with the information of how it sounds and how you can bring your experience and knowledge to the table and give them what they want. At the end of the day, that's what you're going to keep you in the business. That's what's going to keep you paying the bills and improving, because experience is a lot of time more important than the knowledge, because the knowledge doesn't always represent itself into your work. There's so many mistakes done that sound awesome. There's so many things that are against what you learn, and they work. And practices are really a matter of experience. I learned that you can do 1,000 masters and then have 10 of them coming in to you that you fail with them. And it's not because they were not good. It's because you based your knowledge on the ones that you did before and weren't open to understanding what's happening now. And guess what? Even the biggest people and the biggest mastering engineers sometimes lose the gig to someone else. And sometimes it might not be a big person as them. So I think the best advice that I can bring some to the table is try to listen to what the client needs bring yourself into the project and do whatever you can that you think sounds really good, but also understand at the end of the day, it's their call, it's their record, and try to cater it as best as possible. And they might have a good idea that maybe is not exactly what you're thinking of, but it might work. And if it doesn't work, tell them what you think, but still do what they want. At least you told them and you gave them the opportunity to say, you know what, let's not do that. Or, okay, let's try what I asked. And then if they hear it doesn't work, at least now they know that you gave them what they wanted. And you also told them it might not work. So it's a two-way street. And more is more in terms of, like, you just need to do a lot and a lot. It is a numbers game. The more mastering you've done, the more you come across situations, the more you probably will know how to handle it better.
You can find out more about Mayor at mayorapplebaum.com. That's Mayor, M-A-O-R, Applebaum, A-P-P-L-E-B-A-U-M, Mayor Applebaum, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Mixcloud, YouTube Music, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.